Welcome, everyone, to episode number 108 of Underserved. Today, we are featuring Cassio Goldschmidt, Chief Information Security Officer at ServiceTitan. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Cassio, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me here.
So you grew up in Brazil. Like, what was that like, learning technology and trying to discover it down there?
The way it started, it's kind of funny. It started at the beach. There was another boy flying a kite. And I look at that and, you know, approach him and start talking about flying kites. And we became friends. And once we became friends, they start hanging out with each other, went to, you know, each other's homes. And one of the times when I actually went to his home, I saw a computer book was a basic for kids. And I start just flipping, you know, the pages of the book. And I thought it was kind of interesting and, you know, asked my dad to buy the book for me. And that was my summer reading. That's kind of how I got to computers. And because I was reading that book without having a computer, I start telling my dad, hey, I want a computer. Just like, you know, kids want a dog or a puppy. I want a computer. And computers down that time in Brazil were pretty expensive. And after asking several times, he said, yeah, all right, I got your computer. But it's in our home back in the city because we had a home at the beach and that's where we spent summer. So, you know, I came back and I decided to implement whatever was in my mind, not necessarily following the book, which, you know, when my dad saw it, was like, hey, why are you doing that? You should actually follow the steps one by one, what's in the book. You're going to get in trouble here. And I go, no, I think I understand what's in this book. Let me do what's in my mind here. And that's kind of how I got into computers.
Dad, I'm just like riffing. It's like a good guitar solo or something. So do you end up studying computers when you go to college?
Yes, I did. I was very fortunate to go to this college where we had some really great professors. I think it's one of those colleges where you get a personal relationship with your professors. And the projects that we did at school were presented in kind of a arena style. Everyone would go to the lab and there would be like tons of people around the computer while the students would actually present their project that they did for the class. So we could see each other's project. And it was really nice because you learn from other people when they are presenting. And you could always see who were the, you know, the kids who were far ahead and not doing just, you know, checking the box on the project, really doing some great things and start talking to each other and sharing some ideas, some advanced features that you could actually do with the technology at that time.
What was the name of your university?
It was Pontifícia Universidade Católica of Rio Grande do Sul. So it's PUC.RS, as they call. And yeah, to date, I still talk with many of the professors and some of the students that we had there.
Any professors in particular or folks that you found to be good mentors or particularly instructive while you were there?
My mentor for the final project, Eduardo Todi, the person who is now the dean for the school, Avelino Zorzu Agostini. There's so many, and those are just a few that come to mind. And also the people who are doing projects with me, which are like good friends too.
What did you end up doing at Ellipse Software Technology?
So out of all these presentations that we did at school, I start making good friends, and one of them worked in this company called Ellipse Software. Ellipse Software was a SCADA system, a company that did industrial automation. One time I just called them and said, hey, I'm looking for an internship. And as soon as I hang up the phone, he actually called me back and said, yeah, there's an internship for you. And it was really, you know, seconds after, I go, whoa, that's pretty cool. Basically, because it was a very small company, about five or six, I think I was the sixth person to join the company. It was really high, very advanced for the time, you know, what you were doing with industrial automation and doing software for Windows when everyone was using DOS. So I joined the company and it was a very fun time for me because basically what I would do is create drivers. So every day I would get to my desk and there would be a box, and this box would be a scale or a rack of modems, and I have to figure out what it does, how it works, and make it talk back to the software. The company was so great to work with that out of those six people, all the five are still there. And that is like over 30 years ago.
Wow. A lot of companies don't make it 30 years, that's for sure.
Not in the US for sure, yes.
After this, you decide to come to the US and pursue your master's degree. And what happens then?
I was actually finishing school and I thought perhaps I should go abroad and get a little bit of experience. And I was not targeting the US specifically or any company. I was just wanting to go and live abroad for a while, learn a little bit more about technology and get an internship. There was this opportunity to go to a company that I quite frankly knew very little about at the time called Cisco. And sounded like a big company in California. Internship was going to be from maybe a year. And there was a project that they gave to me. So I came to San Jose, start working in this project. It was a project to actually set up the new machines they had that would go to employees. All the software that they had at the time was actually desktop software. So there was a lot of settings that need to be configured for emails, for Office, and all the other things that they had. They gave me this project and, you know, was supposed to be a three-month project. After 1 month, I said, yeah, that's done. I finished this project. And they go, you finish, you mean it's complete with documentation and everything else? And they go, yeah, give me something else to do. And they decide to start using. And it was nice to see that this 1 month or 3 months internship suddenly, you know, became an invitation to stay there for 1 year. And unfortunately, I turned down the opportunity because my life was pretty miserable. You know, every weekend I would just go to computer literacy and get like two books on computers and read all weekend. Of course, you know, with time, this changed. And, you know, I decided to stay and, you know, stay at Cisco for like 6 years.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Marist Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
So what technologies are you working with and what other projects are you working on that time?
Yeah, so after that, there was another project related to video conferencing. And that was very interesting because it was way ahead of time. Cisco always wanted to find use for computers that would increase the usage of the network. Video conferencing seemed to be like cutting edge type of stuff. And that's one of the projects they gave to me. When they start doing IP phones, there was another one that I work with. And I think from all the projects that I've done, there were two that I think really made a difference. One was doing Y2K. We're trying to release an agent from a startup. Unfortunately, this agent was coded using Java, and Java was a great idea, but way too heavy for the technology there. And without, you know, seeing that this would not work in our desktops that we had, management turned to me and said, can you rewrite this in C++, make it light, save us from the Y2K bug? And that's pretty much what happened. The other project, I just did on my own. And one weekend, I was at home with my girlfriend and we were talking. And suddenly I had this crazy idea of doing an extension for a new operating system, which was Windows 2000, was still in beta. I told her, hey, I have to go back to work and I have to code this thing right now. And I stayed, you know, on a Sunday night until like 4 a.m., start coding this thing on my own. A couple weeks after, when I sorted all the bugs, I sent to a couple friends at Cisco, and the thing spread like fire. Everyone loved this extension that I wrote to for the new Windows beta, up to the point it became like one of the fifth top deployed applications at the company without ever being a real IT asset that was deployed. And that led to the first patent that I created. One of the managers saw this and said, hey, this is really different and you should apply for a patent. And I was thinking, that's crazy. I mean, I don't think I deserve a patent, right? It's out of my league. Patents are for like people who are geniuses. And then they hooked me up with a lawyer to actually talk about what I created. I would tell the lawyer would actually tell me what he wrote, and I go, no, that's not exactly this. And then he would just regurgitate and say exactly what I was doing. And I go, that's right. He goes, yeah, what I wrote here is the legal version of what you created. And it was very different from what I actually created. The interesting part is that after we filed a patent and we got the patent, it took several years to get that patent, up to the point that something that I created for a beta version of Windows 2000 only came when Windows XP was out.
Now, what did this extension do that was so useful that people liked?
It was a directory lookup. So basically, just like you have your type your search here that Microsoft has today in every desktop, I had something that you could actually type somebody's name and a menu would pop up with all the information from all the Jones in the company. And you could click and get to email or to the directory page or, you know, schedule a meeting with the person. Just launching a web browser, which was the other option that we had, was quite heavy at the time. So there was a quick and dirty way to actually get somebody's information, click and make a call with your voice over AP phone and things like that.
Okay. Are you using like Active Directory or LDAP or?
Exactly. At the time, it was using LDAP. The funny part is that after I left at Cisco, this was used for several years with like minimal maintenance from other people. And one day I was having meetings and somebody from Cisco was at the meeting and I saw that the person was using this extension. And I went to the person and said, hey, can you do me a favor and type in this application just about? And the person was looking at me, no, this is an internal application. Why am I going to do this for you? And who are you in the first place, right? I said, please just do that. It was an Easter egg that I left in the application that would pop up my name and say, hey, this was coded. It was still there. It was really nice to see that after several years out of the company, you know, the Easter egg and everything was still intact in the way that I coded.
So you hinted that you moved on from Cisco. You went to Symantec next?
Yes. One of the things about Cisco is that it was always very focused at that time in, you know, routers and network and things like that. Everything was like, how can we actually increase the usage of the network? How can we actually sell more routers? Symantec was a pure play software company and specifically in security. So I moved to Symantec. In my new job, I was the senior principal software engineer developing the Symantec endpoint protection software, the enterprise version of the antivirus. And that's one software that, believe it or not, all the viruses want to attack because it was widely deployed. And if you can neutralize that software, you pretty much own the machine. Not to mention that antivirus, a lot of times, run with high privileges. You could actually get into kernel mode and things like that. So with that, I learned quite a lot about security and most of all, defensive programming.
You wouldn't think that the virus people would attack the antivirus software, but it makes sense if you can actually overcome it. Elevated privs, you're in God mode on that machine. So you moved to Southern California, Santa Monica. What was different when you got there?
Yeah, so Santa Monica was different in the sense that it was a real city. I think when you go in Silicon Valley, everyone works for different technology companies, but essentially everyone is after the next big thing. It works in similar projects or there's a similar environment, although cultures can be a little bit different from each other's. And in Santa Monica, you start having friends who were, you know, doctors or artists, musicians. And one of the things that I started doing again was to play volleyball, which was a longtime passion. I was playing competitively when I was in high school. And I actually got into a team. It was a lot of fun. It was like after work hours, after the volleyball league, we would go to a bar and talk and have fun. One night there was, you know, people actually made the same question you made, Andrew, you know, what made me move to Southern California and what was the difference? And I told them that everyone in Silicon Valley was pretty much a technology gig. And everyone was looking with their beers in their hands at me like, do you know what I do for a living? And I go, no, I have no idea. And yeah, I'm a sysadmin. And the other person was actually teaching, you know, computers and everyone was involved with technology. We just never talk about it.
You can't escape the tech industry.
Yes, it's everywhere.
So after being there for a while, you get promoted to a senior manager of product security. What changes for you then?
Yes, that was an interesting promotion. Basically, I was a software engineer who, you know, became quite frankly, quite paranoid about security. And whenever there was code reviews, I would find things and so on. And it got attention of our product security team that we had at the time. And the director of that team said, hey, Cassio, why don't you join this team and do security, you know, full time? And so I did. And after a couple of months, when I joined the team, the director actually resigned. And she came to me and said, you know what? I think you would be the ideal leader for this team. You have your computer science degree, you have your master's in software engineer, you're doing an MBA, you understand the business. I think that's what the team needs. I think they need somebody who is more technical to convey to our executives what needs to be done and also work with the external community and move forward where we are in security. It was a pretty big challenge at the time because there were people in that team who were icons in this small world of application security. They wrote books and they were pretty well known, and I was not the senior most person in this team. And I still had to actually accommodate and make sure that they were doing the work and, you know, listen to what they are doing. And at the same time, you know, move the team in the direction that I wanted. Overall, it was just a great position because, you know, I was able to also work with several different companies such as EMC, Symantec, Microsoft, SAP, Oracle, and so on, and publish a lot of papers that I think helped to shape a lot of the things that we think about application security these days.
Yeah, people forget back then, like this is before static code analysis. This is before a lot of the tools that exist today that we take for granted existed. And you were definitely kind of at the forefront of pushing security to the front of everyone's mind.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there was one story that when I was still an engineer, somebody came with static code analysis tool and showed me. And quite frankly, after the meeting, I thought, this is a glorified grep. It's just looking for, you know, the word password in my code. And whenever somebody says, you know, enter the password here or something like that, it would flag as a critical vulnerability. And I told the security team, hey, just come back when you have something that works. So it was very interesting lesson because even today when I work with engineers, I feel their pain. I feel that, you know, if people are just throwing tools over the fence, it doesn't work. And, you know, people talk about shift left and so on. You got to be very careful what you actually give to engineers or your reputation might be on the line.
Yeah, I've used some static code analysis and some tools will give you a large number of false positives. And it just makes you have so much less confidence in the tool. And you feel like, all right, well, now I have to code some sort of workaround just to get this thing to check the box when it's not actually a problem. And other times it finds legitimate like things that you need to fix or else you are opening up a legitimate vulnerability. It can be frustrating when there's a mix of the two.
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately what happens is you lose confidence in the tool and you see, okay, false positive. Well, this third thing is kind of hard to understand false positive, right? Let's not waste time trying to understand what the tool is telling you because you just don't have any confidence anymore.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So, Symantec's generally a desktop, maybe server install, but you kind of had the itch to be more of an internet company. Where do you go next?
Yeah, so it is very true. Symantec for a long time was a desktop company, was a company doing endpoint software, and things were moving to the cloud. And there was this opportunity to go to Intuit and not only go there, but also help shape the security of different business units for very well-known products. So when that opportunity came and cloud was just rising and, you know, financial companies were actually thinking about going to the cloud, but were in doubt whether it was secure enough, was when I joined Intuit.
And what do you end up doing there? How do your responsibilities broaden?
Yeah, so I was responsible for a few business units there. One specific was the Intuit Financial Service. And Intuit Financial Service is a business unit that would do white label banking applications for credit unions and medium and small banks. So the requirement for security is very high. Not only the requirements for security, but also the requirements for compliance. In the middle of this time when I was managing this business unit and helping with security, the company Intuit decided to divest that business unit. And with that, we became an independent company and had to get out of the Intuit data centers because we were in the middle of our journey to the cloud. At the same time, have the FFIC to come and do an audit. And FFIC is an institution that has Steve and will actually potentially shut down your business if you don't have security. And do that within 6 months after we, you know, move out of Intuit. So it was a very challenging time. One of the things that we had to do was to find vendors and also to do our vendor management of the vendors that we had. And I remember one time where I was doing the vendor managed questionnaires and sending to our vendors, getting their responses. And one of the questions that we had was about cross-site scripting and whether they had any vulnerabilities such as cross-site scripting in their code that still needs to be fixed. And one of the vendors came back and said, we don't have cross-site scripting, but we're thinking about implementing next quarter.
So for folks who don't know, cross-site scripting is a vulnerability that can be exploited over the internet. And the salesperson was basically offering to introduce this vulnerability into his code, thinking that this was a net positive for his questionnaire.
Exactly. That's when I noticed that, yes, if you send a questionnaire and it goes to the wrong hands, it's useless, right? You're better off actually creating a relationship with the right people in the company. And even if they don't have all the security bells and whistles, at least you know they have a vision and they have the right intentions to make things secure.
Now, you got involved with a little startup too, right?
Yes, that's right. The name of the startup, it was SuperPlayer. Back then, iPod was, you know, something that everyone was using. And I would look at that device and it really didn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm not a big Apple fan, to be quite honest. And one day I went to a store and a friend was actually purchasing a iPod and asked, hey, how many songs can you actually put in this thing? And then I start thinking and I go, actually as many as I want. I actually have to go back home and I have to implement something. And I noticed that cell phones were at a point that you had HTML5 and you could do progressive download and you don't need to actually carry all your songs with you. So I implemented an application that would get to my home server and just stream all the songs that I had for myself. And I showed to my brothers and they love it. A project that I did in the middle of the night and said, you know, hey, we have to make a company out of it. And that, you know, was the start of a company called SuperPlayer, which became a company that Google invested. We presented at FATE, the Facebook conference, and at some point got a lot of users, I think 4.5 million users in Brazil.
Oh, wow. You got your brothers involved in it too, right?
Yeah. One of my brothers is a lot younger than I am. He was doing an internship and, you know, said, I want to actually be part of this company. I will sell my car to actually invest in the company. And he was just out of college. And my other brother was looking and saying, do we want this guy to be involved? I've worked in other things with him before and said, he is going to be one of the best CEOs that I know. I think very highly of him to date as one of the most thorough CEOs that I've worked with.
So in Brazil, like, you know, they tended to not have the rapid adoption of, you know, software like in the US. So SuperPlayer gets a lot of adoption pretty quickly, right?
Yes, it did, because basically it was very convenient. Before, you would have to upload all your songs to an iPod, and suddenly you have something that, you know, you just go to a website, you choose the genre of music you want to hear, and you play, and there was like curated playlists according to what you like, kind of like Pandora. That made a lot of difference. People don't know what they want to play. When they first created the SuperPlayer, the original version, you had to actually type it up. I want to hear the Rolling Stones. And I remember telling people, hey, you can hear anything, any music that I had in my, you know, all my CDs. What do you want to hear? And people would say, I don't know. play something that's familiar. And people start loving this kind of applications when they hear something familiar, but it's followed by something that's similar in nature, but not necessarily what they know. And they go, oh my God, this is really nice. And I never heard about this band. I'm a big fan. And that's what made Super Player so popular.
Yeah, it reminds me of like Spotify has that radio feature where you listen to a song you know you like, and then they try to play you other songs that they think are sonically similar or other things you might like. Speaking of big bad Spotify, eventually they do come to Brazil, and that's kind of an existential threat. What happens next?
Yes, at some point we noticed, okay, Spotify has millions of songs, and although people usually tend to hear to a few songs they like and, you know, some variations, people go for the millions. And quite frankly, the price that they were asking was less than what we would need to charge in order to just survive. So the company had to pivot. And this day, SuperPlayer does a number of other things. One of them is we did music systems for airplanes. So there are some airlines in Brazil that use that. There's SuperPlayer for TVs. There were also some podcasts that were created out of the company. One was led by my brother and was a podcast about just business in general. And at one point, this podcast became so popular in the country that iTunes has the rank for business podcasts. He was number one above Harvard Business Review, which I thought was a pretty big honor. The other thing that happened with the podcast is he created a podcast for kids with kids' stories that were original, created by SuperPlayer. And even today, now and then, we see kids' parties that people send their pictures. They're based on the characters that SuperPlayer created. And that's very fulfilling to see that kids are actually asking for this kind of things in their birthday parties.
That's cool that it lives on. So around the same time frame for your official day job, Intuit had a spinoff that gets acquired by NCR. What do you do while working for NCR?
Yeah, so NCR was really trying to get all the things that we needed to do from the divestiture that Intuit had and try to get everything back in shape. So in other words, I was trying to start things from pretty much a blank page. And that was quite challenging because, you know, you have to shop for several different type of products. You need to hire people and you have all these audits that are about to come. And they're quite serious for, you know, in the banking industry. Fortunately, at NCR, they had a CISO who was incredibly skillful. And one of the people who I try to emulate today, basically, he made a lot of deals for us to get the tools that we need with major companies, got some unheard discount that would fit in our budget, you know, make things work really well.
And you guys are dealing with like lots of compliance obligations and having to, you know, adhere to a bunch of government regulations. What's that like?
That is just one of the, you know, things that we have to deal. There's also the fact that, you know, in the banking industry, you have a lot of CISOs who are very savvy in what they do. And the fact that they outsource the core system for their business also led to a number of questionnaires, which, you know, we were packed with questionnaires all the time.
You mentioned also earlier talking about having teeth in a contract, you know, that if there's violations, then this happens. This reminds me of a quick story. A lawyer friend of mine was reviewing a contract for someone and it said basically, hey, if you take this from us, then you're not supposed to do that. And of course, like, they signed this contract with people and sometimes people would take the stuff from them. And he said, you know what? This needs to have teeth. You need to like come up with a formula of money that is reasonable, but penal. And like people are not going to want to violate it. And once they put that in, then people stop violating this part of the contract. So having the teeth in there definitely matters.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are different types of compliance that you see in the industry, and you see a big difference, you know, between the ones that have teeth and will do something such as PCI and FFIC and others that just don't have the same power to actually, you know, penalize or give negative incentives if you don't do something right.
Now, you do some consulting, forensic type stuff. Tell me about your time at Aon when you were vice president of their cyber resilience practice.
So it was another acquisition that happened and I became a vice president there. Basically, the interesting thing about Aon is they were really focused on cyber insurance. They acquired the company that was before because there was a lot of data about forensics, and that data could be mined in order to do the best business models to predict prices for insurance. So insurance is a new business, and I think to date, people are trying to determine the best models, and that's what they were essentially trying to do, was to understand what companies were more prone to have attacks and what are the best controls that will guarantee your security, your safety. And there's some interesting researchers coming that actually say with data, here are the most effective controls. One of them actually is just hardening of your desktops and your laptops and your overall, you know, server base. Why a lot of people in security always thought was identity and two-factor authentication, strong passwords.
Yeah, I've watched this evolve over time. Like when I first got into business in 2003, like you'd get some general liability insurance and maybe an umbrella and some auto, and you're off and running as a business. And then bigger clients started asking for errors and omissions insurance, which was used to be for like realtors. If they listed a listing and like, you know, it didn't have a heated pool or whatever, you know, it would kind of cover that sort of stuff. But it evolved into cyber, which was sometimes part of errors and omissions or sometimes was its own endorsement or policy. And everyone got very interested then in like preventing intrusions and preventing malware and ransomware and all the bad things that can happen, or, you know, even an employee going and putting a bad Easter egg into a client's software.
Yeah, and there was a pandemic of ransomware a couple of years ago when the insurance prices went up like 74%, which is just crazy, right? And some business, they, you know, they would look at and say, oh, you don't have two-factor authentication? We're not going to insure you. You're out of insurance. And small companies, that is a really big risk to take not to have insurance. But at the same time, it was something that they just could not afford to have it. So I think this is still going on today, unfortunately, and that's a big problem for tech companies, especially the small ones. Eventually, it led me to another company called ServiceTitan, and was very interesting. Basically, during my MBA years, there was another classmate that was already in ServiceTitan. And one day she calls me and say, hey, we're looking for somebody to be the CISO in this company. And the company was still in the infancy. There were good things that were going on related to security, but given how fast the company was growing and where it was heading, they need a lot more. And what's going to become not only a full-time position, but really creating a team around and a lot of structure. And that structure didn't exist. So she came and she said, what do you think about coming to a company that has minimal security at this point? And I told her, I love it. I think that this is an opportunity to do things in a way that is very unique and very different from all the Fortune 500 companies that I was before. Of course, I learned a lot from those companies, and that's the ultimate goal, is to serve the company in a very structured way. But the technology changed. And because the technology changed, you had a lot of different solutions that needed to be used. And those solutions came from startups that you had to actually search for them and work as business partners in order to get the type of solution that you need. And that is something that we do today with a lot of companies. I tell people I love to prove Gartner wrong. Not that Gartner is wrong, but, you know, technology is always changing, and whoever is on the top of that Gartner list, when there's a technology shift, sometimes they have nowhere to go other than restart what some startups already start doing and are ahead of the game.
You had a funny story about your CFO who went down to Brazil.
Yes. So we have a new CFO, and this CFO is actually American. And he spent several years in Brazil. He actually married a Brazilian lady and moved to Rio. Eventually, he decided to come back to the US and came to work for ServiceTitan. And he's in Glendale, where I am. And one day, after exchanging a couple messages in Portuguese and introducing myself and so on, but never meeting him in person, I go down the stairs in one of our floors and I see him. And he looks at me and open his arms and give a big smile and, "Hey, Cassio." And I look at him and I just extend my arm to shake hands. And I go, "Oh my God." I mean, the guy now, you know, acts like a Brazilian. And I'm acting like an American after, you know, years here. What happened to me?
So he goes in for the big hug and you're like, no, we're shaking hands.
Exactly.
Now, you were also a founding member of the LA chapter of OWASP as well, right? What do they do?
Yeah. So the Open Web Application Security Project is no not-for-profit organization that wants to make security visible. There wasn't a chapter in LA. And at the time when I was at Symantec, I wanted to bring a little bit more web knowledge to all of us. So I decided, okay, I will host the meetings here at Symantec because we have a beautiful facility in Culver City. I was trying to create this community in Los Angeles. And it started with like 6 people in the first meeting, a meeting with a presenter that was just talking on the phone because we didn't have anybody around to invite, and start growing. There was long time ago, one person, Sammy Kankar, who actually created the first WARM on the web, was the Sammy is my hero that infected MySpace. Basically, what this guy wanted to do is just make everyone who visits his page would actually get in their own page something saying, and above all, Sammy is my hero. And he didn't realize that what he created would not only infect his friends with the saying in the profile, but also his friends' friends and so on. So the next morning when he woke up and saw what happened, he had more than 1 million friends because everybody who had that, and above all, Sam is my hero, also sent a friend invitation to him and eventually put MySpace down. You know, he got in legal trouble. He was underage and he, you know, had to do some community services and so on. And I remember just reading the story and going, this guy is in Los Angeles. Let me invite him. You know, I sent email cold called Sammy to talk, and he came and talked at one of our meetings. And after the meeting, he goes and say, "Yeah, today's my birthday, and I don't know what to do because all my friends and everything else after this legal trouble that I had are gone." And I go, "Gee, let's go have some beers," right? And we went together, and you know, Sammy is one of the most prolific people in security with some of the most interesting attacks against drones and credit cards and everything else. And he's a white hack. He never tried to do something that was malicious. But that's one of the examples of people that we got to those meetings, and the meetings start growing up to the point that today we have about 3,000 members on Meetup, very strong community that start from just 6 people way back then.
Very nice. Now, what do you do for hobbies when you're not banging away on the keyboard for work?
Yeah, so I still bang on the keyboard for a lot of things. I love to code, and you know, I still do some personal projects like I used to do when I was 13 years old, or you know, any time of my career. The other hobby that I have is to do music, electronic music that is, which unfortunately is also in the computer, just like video producing, another hobby that I do. But outside the computer, I love to play tennis. I love to do beach volleyball still, and just spend time with family, you know, do things with my son. We're highly involved with scouts these days, which, you know, takes us to different camping trips. So those are some of the things that we still do, and it's a lot of fun.
Any causes or charities that you're passionate about?
Yeah, so OWASP is one of them. I recently won a community award in Israel. That was for the work that I did partially with OWASP, partially with other communities such as ISC Square, and even a course that I did for LinkedIn, which got 12,000 people trained in that course in privacy. And when I went to Israel, they came up with this prize and they said, "Yeah, you're going to get $5,000. You can donate to any institution you want." And, you know, it went back to OWASP.
Very cool. Cassio, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with the listeners of Underserved your experiences.
Andrew, this was a lot of fun. Thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.